Hello and welcome to The Exchange this afternoon. Clearly, I am not Ed Stetzer. Ed is away, actually traveling internationally this week. My name is Micah Fries. I serve here along with Ed as the Vice President of Lifeway Research, and we are excited to be back with you this week for another episode of The Exchange. We think that we've got a show for you today that is going to be encouraging, challenging, and hopefully will help provoke you as Scripture reminds us to love and good deeds. And so what we want to deal with today is really two topics that I think the church struggles with, two that I think we can hopefully speak into, help encourage you, and maybe provide some insight that you won't find other places. The first is this. When you think about the core of the Christian faith, the core of our responsibility, the core of our call to obedience, nothing looms larger than that of being and making disciples, right? And so, in fact, when you think about the Christian call, the Great Commission itself, Jesus is standing there with his disciples ready to ascend into heaven, and he gives them one final charge, one final commission, one final command. And this command is that they would go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to observe all things that Jesus had commanded them. And yet, when we look at the church today, when we think about what it is that we view as effective and what we view as success, we measure any number of things. We measure attendance, and we measure baptism, and we measure offerings, and we measure all of these different things. But I wonder sometimes how well we do at making disciples and whether or not we would even know if we were actually doing a good job of making disciples. We want to talk about that today. We want to talk about maybe what it looks like to effectively make disciples. We're going to talk to a pastor and a leader who is working in unique ways to make disciples and has a strategy that he's using to make disciples that I think you'll find compelling. And so I'm excited about doing that. But then the second thing that I want us to look at today is an element of disciple making that, again, the church seems to struggle with, and that is specifically church planting and disciple making in the urban core. Sociologists have told us this for a long time, that over the past few decades, the past couple of generations, we have seen the church literally engage away from the urban core, move out of the urban core and move into the suburbs, into the rural areas. And because of that, when you look at the scattering of churches across the country, we've got churches who have moved away from the urban core. They populate less populous areas of the country. And yet in response to that, the country, and not just the U.S., but the world as a whole, is migrating into the urban core. And so you have churches who have left the urban core, you have people moving into the urban core, and now we have this situation where you have a tremendous amount of churches who are in areas where the population isn't nearly as dense, and yet where you have these great pockets of density, it doesn't seem like we're doing a great job of seeing great amounts of churches planted and thriving. And the pastor that we're going to speak to today is working in the urban core, not only in his own city, but is helping to advance the gospel in powerful ways in urban environments around the country. He's working not only in these urban contexts, but he's working with multi-ethnic churches and seeing a diverse group of leaders developed and advanced. And so we want to talk to him, maybe think a little bit together with him about what it looks like to effectively make disciples, and specifically what it looks like to effectively make disciples in the urban core, engaging a diversity of leaders for the sake of the gospel, for the advance of the gospel, for the sake of the name of our great God. And so when we come back in just a minute, we're going to go to a commercial break here, and when we come back in just a minute, I'm going to introduce our speaker to you. We're going to give you an opportunity to engage with him. If you're watching today live, we want to encourage you to jump in the chat room that's right here on the screen in front of you, or engage us in social media. If you're on Twitter, if you would use hashtag TheExchange, we'll be glad to respond to you. And if you'll submit questions either through the chat room or through the social media environments, we'll grab those and we'll try and submit some of those questions to our speaker. And here in just a little bit, we're going to offer a free ebook that he's offered that you can pick up today just exclusively for those of you who are watching live today on The Exchange. We're going to go to this commercial, and in just a minute, we'll be back and we'll spend some time with our special guest today. Take a look at this and we'll come right back.
Every great story begins with a voice giving shape to darkness. A storyteller speaking characters into existence, and it's good. In fact, it's perfect. Enter the villain, one who wishes to change the story, to bring death to mankind, to unmake the storyteller's good world. Our inciting incident, where everything goes wrong. The villain tells the characters they can create their own story, and they believe the lie. Death is sentenced, and the characters are enslaved. The villain is triumphant. But all is not lost. The storyteller is not idle. He has a plan. But it will take time and sacrifice. The people face extinction. Yet they are not swept away. They face death, but a substitute is given. They face captivity, and the storyteller provides their escape. Yet they remain chained by the villain. But a promise is made. Serpent is lifted high on a staff and brings healing. An unlikely king frees his people. From an ocean tomb comes a message of life, hints of a great rescuer, and then nothing. The story goes quiet. The people fear the storyteller has forgotten his promise. The rescue begins. The storyteller enters the story. He heals the sick, brings hope to the captive. He loves the unlovable. The villain plots his vengeance. He strikes, and the hero's life is given for his people. His promise fulfilled. The substitute is sacrificed. The people are again free, and the hero emerges from his tomb. He gathers his people and sends them out as storytellers. More believe. Their numbers grow. One story told over thousands of years. My story. Your story. His story. This is The Gospel Project.
And welcome back to The Exchange. We are excited to have you here. Again, I'm clearly not Ed Stetzer. I don't have anything close to the Duck Dynasty goatee, or the half crowder, as he likes to call it, going on. But Ed is actually traveling internationally today. My name is Micah Fries. We're glad to have you here on The Exchange this afternoon. We have a special guest with us today. Dahati Lewis is our guest for the day. Dahati is the pastor of Blueprint Church in Atlanta, Georgia, in the urban core of Atlanta. Let me tell you a little bit about Dahati, and then we'll bring him here on screen and get to know him a little bit better, spend some time together. Dahati was born and raised in Southern California. His dad was an NFL football player, and so grew up kind of with the dream of being an NFL player himself. And after receiving a full scholarship to go play at the University of North Texas in Denton, Texas, in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, through a series of events, the Lord moved in his heart and helped him point him not in the direction of football per se, but in the direction of working in the church and serving the church. And so Dahati graduated from the University of North Texas. While he was there as a student, started a Bible study that was very successful by all external standards. And so after he graduated from college, went on staff with Campus Crusade for Christ and traveled around Texas helping replicate these Bible studies on college campuses. He went to Dallas Theological Seminary, where he graduated with a Master of Arts in Cross-Cultural Ministries, and then served on staff at Denton Bible Church there in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. While he was there as a part of the staff at Denton Bible Church, launched a successful collegiate ministry. But while he was doing that, the Lord planted in his heart a desire to work in the urban core, to plant a church for the sake of the gospel and for the advance of the gospel. And so he went and spent a year in Little Rock, Arkansas with Fellowship Associates, where he did an internship, training, if you will. and then went from there to Atlanta, Georgia, where he and 25 people together planted what is today known as Blueprint Church. Blueprint's been just blessed by the Lord. They see people coming to faith consistently. And not only has Blueprint been successful, but Dehati is now serving as pastor of Blueprint and also as the leader of a movement called the Rebuild Initiative, where they are working to equip churches in the urban core to encourage, empower, urban ministries, and to multiply disciples in the context of the city. Dehati is married to Angie. They have 6 children, Trinity, Jade, Briah, Dehati Jr., Braden, and Christian. And Dehati, I may have messed up some of those names. I apologize if I did. I hope you'll welcome with me Dehati Lewis to the show. Dehati, we're glad that you could be here with us today, man.
Yeah, I'm excited. That was kind of scary, all that information that you have about me. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm excited.
Glad to have you. Why don't we just jump right in? In fact, before we jump right in, though, I do want to mention we're going to be giving away your free ebook today, a book called In Plain Sight, A Primer for Reclaiming Discipleship in the Local Church. We're excited about that. In order to receive a copy of that, if you're in the chat room, you should be able to click on the link that we'll be dropping in there. Notice the link here on the screen, bit.ly/exchange-giveaway. Make sure you get those capitals right, and let us know you're interested, and we'll get a copy of that book to you. Thank you, Dehati, for making that book available to us. Why don't we just jump right in by telling us just a little bit more of your story? I know I gave the bio, but tell us a little bit more about your life, how the Lord changed your heart, transformed you, and then how Blueprint Church came into being.
I'm excited to be here on the show. My life is, like you said, I was raised in a football family. So basically, every Sunday, my sanctuary was football. You know, did that growing up. Everything I did and didn't do was based upon my desire to play sports. And really what interesting took place is that I didn't get a scholarship to a major Division I school after college, after high school. And it really had me started to search for something other than more than like sports. And so it was in the midst of that I started, you know, studying different types of world religions. I started studying Hinduism, Buddhism, the Nation of Islam. I started studying a lot of different religions with the idea of there has to be more than like sports. And, you know, in 1995, it was Christianity, I realized that the only thing that said, you're not good enough, and you need a Savior. And so in the summer of 1995, I gave my life to the Lord. That's when I got a scholarship to the University of North Texas, and then moved to Denton, Texas. And that's really where my life as a believer really began to take off.
Good deal, man. So tell us, how is it exactly that the Lord kind of moved you to the point where Atlanta was your destination, and where you then moved with a group of, 25 people, I think it is, to Atlanta? How did that happen? How did Blueprint Church come into being?
Yeah. Well, on December 15th of 2007 is when 25 of us made a commitment to leave Texas to move to Atlanta, Georgia, to plant a church. And so we were excited that a number eventually went to about 40 individuals that moved here in the year 2009-2010 to help us start Blueprint Church. The story that kind of behind that is, you know, when I first got to the University of North Texas, I'll never forget today, January 10th of 1996, I met a guy named Art Hooker. Art Hooker introduced me to the first Christian community, and it just really blew my mind because it was all these people who were talking about, like, discipleship, like David and Goliath, Samson and Delilah, and all that. Who are these people? But just in their casual conversations, they would have, but not growing up in the church, I felt like I needed to catch up. So, like, I had a kind of a football mentality. So I would go to a Bible study every single night. I kind of called it with, like, my spiritual tour day. It was when I was, like, you know, every single night going, and I felt like I needed to catch up because everyone else seemed to know their Bible except me. And so it was during that time that I started going to different Bible studies like Crusade, University, all the different things. And I started learning about terms that even my friends weren't talking about. They were talking about discipleship and evangelism. And I learned for the first time that, man, this is something that my friends were not even talking about. I knew they loved the Lord and they knew a bunch of Bible stories, but they were not talking about, like, Christianity to them was things like, don't go to the club, don't drink, don't have sex outside of marriage. But it was never, so we knew what God was not calling us not to do, but no one ever would talk about what God was calling us to do. And it was really that evangelism and disciple making that really drove everything we did. And so, as a student, we started a ministry that was geared around both evangelism and disciple making. And we also started about how can we create an environment that we can invite our friends and people that were more geared around the urban context. So that's really what we started. And as a student, first as a student, I graduated in 1998. And then it just kind of kept going into church plant, to our college ministry. That college ministry was successful to the point where we started having people who weren't in college coming to our Bible study. And we were like, okay, this is not a college ministry. This is more like a church. And from there, it went to a, we started a church. So after launching that church, we started realizing that our story wasn't a unique story. That there was a bunch of people across the country that felt like, man, they felt like kind of third culture. Either they was around a group of people who understood their context, like the urban core, but they didn't have the same commitment to the Bible or urban discipleship or disciple making. Or they were around a group of people who had a commitment to discipleship and disciple making, but they didn't understand their context, the urban core. And so that was really the first of why we was like, we need to start a church that could be a blueprint. A church that is in the city, for the city, that looks like.
All right.
So that's how we launched Blueprint Church, and the dream or the goal to launch Blueprint Church came in December 15th, 2000.
And that's encouraging, Dahati. You were recently, you spoke just a few weeks ago in Missouri at an event with some friends of mine, and I was reading a report about your time there, and you used this illustration of fishermen, and I thought it was a helpful analogy when it comes to disciple making. So I'd like to take a few minutes. Let's just talk about discipleship and disciple making and your strategy for accomplishing that. But maybe why don't you, for those of us who weren't there, could you maybe kind of go through that whole illustration of fishermen in relationship to contemporary discipleship for us?
The basis of the analogy that I pretty much that I got on about Christianism is it's about how, as believers, we talk about fishing, being fishers of men. We define fishing. We build big fishermen headquarters. We do everything that centers around fishing, about being fishers of men, except for actually going out and fishing. You know, and so the whole story is, our illustration is captured around all the things that we do around it, but then we don't actually do the actual duty of going out and making disciples or going out and doing fishing. What's interesting about it is that, in the story, it talks about how, you know, as soon as a couple of people get a little bit of success of actually doing fishermen, what we do is that we take them and we put them on stages and conferences and concerts and things like that as ones who have great experience in fishing. And so it takes them all out of the field of actually fishing, and then they become the expert at fishing. And they kind of live in this perpetual cycle of not actually doing the very thing that our great Lord Savior called us to do, is to go and make disciples of all men. You know, the startling reality is that conservative stats tell us that 95% of Christians never intend on sharing their faith or winning anyone to the Lord. And so it's really just a plea for us to stop talking about it and actually go about making disciples in it. And so that's really kind of the nature of the illustration of what we, you know, of what I like to urge myself with, you know, as I go out and talk about fishing to other people.
So as you try and live this out in your own context and in your own community, clearly, you know, the church for years has become stronger and stronger when it comes to taking short-term mission trips and going around the world, but we seem like we really struggle oftentimes reaching those in our community, those who live next door to us. And that, you know, leads me to a story that you had also shared before about a neighbor with a no proselytizing sign on the door. And yeah. I thought that was a powerful reminder to us of our own need to engage just those who live on either side of us. Could you share maybe that story with us for a minute?
Yeah, Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing that we have to understand as Christians, I think a lot of times we forgot how to be human, you know, how just to relate to our neighbors and to actually just engage with one another. And so we have a great friend that lives next door. We in our community, Angie and I are really trying to engage with our neighbors, talk. And so we have our neighbor that's next door who is an atheist. She doesn't really believe in you know, and God or anything. It's just a do not proselytize sign on her door. And, you know, but we have become great friends. Our family, we love her to death. We she has keys to our home. We go to their hockey games. They come to our soccer games. It's just a really a good friendship. We watch their pets. They watch our pets. I mean, it's a really friendship. So over the course of time, what has happened, the story that you're talking about was, you know, my daughter was over there one day, and like we were just talking with her, and she saw that do not proselytize kind of with the act, with the Christian, you know, with the Christian sign on there. And my daughter asked her, "Hey, does this mean you don't like us?" You know, and she was just like, "Oh, no, it doesn't mean it's just that, you know, people try to come and tell you what to believe." And so she just kind of started talking about that, and then, you know, it was interesting that we visited her house a month later. The sign is still up on the door at Do Not Proselytize. But what she wrote in a little, you know, fine print on there, she said, "Unless you're the nice neighbors next door." You know, and so that's kind of the idea of just, you know, this is someone that we've talked many times, we love, you know, and our goal is that one day that she would come to know the Lord, but we also want to be her friend in the meantime. And I think that a lot of times, I want to treat death as a person, and I want to treat our family as people. And I think many times as Christians, we don't treat people like people. We treat them as Christ, you know, and it's really about the heartbeat behind what it means to live in the midst of people and just really to engage people in life on life. Now, she knows what we are. She knows what I do. I'm a pastor. She sees her house, and there's 15 to 20 cars that line up in the house. We've invited them many times. So it's not a basic thing. It's just a... But it's also understanding that even if she doesn't accept the Lord the very first time, doesn't mean that she's now my enemy and I'm not going to ever talk to her.
You know, I think one of the things you said a second ago, Dehadi, was helpful to me when you say Christians have forgotten how to be human, forgotten how to relate to people. And then you said that far too often we treat people like projects rather than just like people. One of the things that seems like the Lord's been doing in my heart is just sort of pushing forward this idea that Christians, in order to be fully human and fully Christian, have to both declare and display the gospel, right? So we have to preach it, but we've got to display it through our behaviors. And if we don't, a lack of one will invalidate the other, right? If we don't declare it, we've invalidated the display, and if we don't display it, vice versa. But here, my concern is that far too often we hear things like that and we think of it as a strategy, right? And so we get our little 3 points that we need to share the gospel, our 4 points, and sometimes gospel presentations can be very helpful. I'm not trying to say that they're not, but I worry that far too often we treat living and preaching gospel as sort of a strategic outline rather than just Christ transforming us and lovingly, graciously living and serving among people and engaging them with the gospel while we share with them the hope that's in us. And so it's encouraging to me to hear you share about that. What we're going to do now is we're going to go to a break, and when we come back from the break, we're going to specifically drill down on a discipleship strategy that you're employing at the church, where you open up your home for a series of time and actually have people live with you, which I think a lot of us, it would scare a lot of church leaders, but I think is probably a helpful thing. So let's go to break. We'll come back in just a minute, and we'll continue this. Remember, if you are interested in Dehadi's free book on discipleship, make sure that you use the link that's in the chat room, or just it's bit.ly/exchangegiveaway. You can click on that. It's only possible for those of you who are watching us live. If you're watching us archived, unfortunately, that link is now dead. And then engage us in the chat room and through Twitter, #TheExchange. Let us know the questions you've got so we can ask Dehadi here in just a minute. Watch this commercial. We'll be right back. Thank you.
Esse quam videri.
Esse quam videri. To be.
To be rather than to see.
Rather than to see.
I'm good at appearance.
I'm good at appearance.
Good at...
Good at putting on the show.
Putting on the show of, I know what I'm doing.
But I'm not convinced.
But I'm not convinced.
I want to know the answers to questions.
Questions I don't want to say out loud.
To know what the Bible means in my life. Today.
Today.
The way I act with friends.
The decisions I make.
Where the next steps.
Where next steps will take me.
Take me. Show me.
All right, and welcome back to The Exchange. We're here with special guest Dahati Lewis, pastor of Blueprint Church in Atlanta and leader of the Rebuild Initiative, working in the urban core. We want to take a minute now, Dahati, to talk about your disciple-making strategy. One of the things that I think makes you and makes Blueprint unique is this disciple-making strategy where you open up your home and you invite people to live with you for a series of times. I was reading the other day, have you and your wife been married 11 years? Is that right, about 11 years?
Yes, sir. We've been married since 2001.
Okay. And so, and out of that, all but, what, 2 years, you've had somebody live with you in your home during that time. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah. We just have this commitment to have people live with us. I mean, we just was convicted, really by a book by Dr. Coleman, Robert Coleman, yeah. Master Plan of Evangelism. And, in his chapter on association, it says that, you know, quoting the scripture, saying that Jesus was with them, you know, and we just was like, okay, what does it look like to be with those that we are making disciples in the 21st century? And so that's really where we captured the idea of how do we recapture the art of hospitality by using our house as weapon for the gospel.
So how does that work, Dahati? I mean, tell us, kind of walk us through what this looks like on a regular basis for you if you were engaging in this discipleship strategy.
Yeah, so basically, well, we have a rhythm at our house. And the rhythm that we have is basically every August through May, we have two to three individuals living in our home. And at the end of May, and we'll just kind of walk through them on life-on-life discipleship. They're involved in our family. They're connecting with our kids. They're just a part of what we are. And we'll get up and we'll do devotions together. We'll just do a lot of those things together. But then what we do is in the summertime, we do this thing called FEM, Strength in Motion. And it's we bring about 6 to 8 singles into our home. And while they're there, basically what they do is we learn about how to share the gospel, how to study their word. We're showing them our marriage. Showing them our lives, we're showing them a lot of different things. And what's interesting about it is that we're teaching them just practical skills, because especially in the urban context, I know we always kind of redeem mind. You know, we teach them solid biblical principles, but a lot of times we don't understand just like how to pay our bills. We don't know how to treat a woman, the basic necessities of life. And so what we try to do is recapture that. So during that time, we'll have dinner together. We'll do different things, spaces, just try to redeem out of the home as we're teaching them the gospel.
So, Dahati, clearly that is going to be at some level somewhat of an inconvenience to you, right? It disrupts the rhythms of your family life with your children. In what ways do you see this strategy effectively leading to the development and creation and development of disciples in such a way that it creates a value enough that you're glad for the disruption to occur because this works? I mean, are you seeing this? In what ways are you seeing this fulfilled?
Well, I mean, when you start doing something like this for 11 years, this doesn't become a disruption to the family. It becomes a part of the very essence of our family. Our kids actually wouldn't even know what to do if it was just us in the house. I mean, it's sort of as quiet as for us. I mean, and what's interesting about it is, like, even a couple of people who live with us now, Andy and I, have just realized that we are split directly between the age of life. There's a 12-year difference between us and them, and then there's a difference, about that same amount of difference between them and our children. And so it gives our children actually kind of a next stage up of what it is for, what it looks like for them and their next season of life versus kind of what it is as mom and dad. And it gives them also to see other people living out their faith, that this is not just a mom and dad thing. You know, and another thing that we've learned about it is that we don't discipleship or disciple making just as a, this is a me and Angie thing, but we see this as a, this is a family thing. And this is the one part of the family and what we do with living in our house that we all do as a family. You know, we're all participating in that. And so it's not something that mommy and daddy is doing, but it's something that we all do as a family.
You know, one of the things that's striking to me, Dahati, about this is that it seems like in a U.S. context or maybe in a Western context, this would seem foreign, this would seem difficult. I've lived a couple of places in Africa and Asia, and it would seem like in those environments, this wouldn't be abnormal at all. This would be normal. There's a lot more group living, you know what I mean, where families live together and communities live together. And so it would seem like this could be interpreted as a more of an Eastern perspective on disciple making, something that probably was more similar or accustomed to what Jesus would have done in his day. This is just one of those areas where, as Americans, I think our cultural identity pushes back against what could be an effective disciple making strategy. Would you agree with that?
Oh, 100%. I mean, you gotta realize what the country was built on. We were built on the Declaration of Independence, and you know, and so for the goal of many Americans is for us to be financially independent. Well, we don't need anybody. But, you know, that's just, I don't believe that that's the goal of Scripture. I really believe that, you know, and I've adopted the idea that it takes the, you know, the old African proverb says, it takes a village to raise a child. We believe that it's the church to raise a Christian. And it's important for us to establish this principle of life-on-life disciple-making as very key to what we're doing. You know, and so I think we all talk about life-on-life discipleship, but I think we reduce life on life disciples to a once-a-week meeting at Starbucks where I'm simply asking you about your life.
I like that, man. It takes a village to raise a child. It takes a church to raise a Christian. I think that's a helpful explanation. Yeah, some folks who could be watching this could say, well, you know, but yeah, Dahati's this super leader. He's impressive. He's abnormal. What about the people that you're leading in the church? Are you seeing this methodology, this process replicated among, you know, other leaders in the church? Are they mimicking your behavior?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the things. Life discipleship is one of the key foundational principles at our church. And this is something that we never try to tell people you have to do it this way. But there is a culture in our church that amongst our members, there's a good portion of them that have to live in their home. One of our other pastors, John Ho, has done the SIMS program. And so while every year, there's up anywhere between 14 to 15 singles that are getting reintroduced or infused with this life-on-life disciple making. And after they go through it, they always never go back to this kind of individualized Christianity. And so it is a part of the very DNA of our church, because when we talk about the church at Blueprint, we say the church is not like a family, but the church is a family. And that's really that breathes through and carries out everything that we do as a church family.
That's helpful. One of the questions we just had come in a second ago, Dahati, is this. What's your criteria for bringing people into your home? How do you determine who it is that you're going to bring into your home and invest in this way?
Yeah, well, one of the things that we do, I mean, people who live in our home are primarily people that we see who are serving within the body, serving within the church. Now, there's been a myriad of people. There's some people that we've just met and that we brought into our home, but there's been some people that we've known for a long time. And so the kind of the qualifications, for the most part, are people who are serious about their faith, who really want to grow, because when we tell people, we say, we're not looking for roommates. We're looking to form a discipleship, a disciple-making relationship. And you know, and so you have to be serious about your faith. So both in our discipleship throughout the year and in our program, it's invitation only. These are only people that we see that are motivated, that want to change. If I were to have a personal mission statement for myself and for my family, it would be influencing the influencers, you know. And so we're really trying to take on people who just need that extra push to but have desire to influence their context for the gospel.
So as you walk through this together, we talked a little bit about some of the unique challenges that at least would seem to be there from an American perspective. From your perspective, what are the unique blessings? Like, what are the benefits as you've walked through this that I think people who are watching right now and who are not engaging in this sort of process might be surprised to hear that you know, that you're experiencing as you walk through this with other people?
Yeah, I mean, the blessings are numerous to count, really. The reality is that I don't pastor so I can preach. I pastor so I can make disciples. And really, the truth of that is that even if, like, if you can take away my preaching, you can take away all the things, but having people live in our home is something that we would never take away, because it is so sanctifying for me and my wife. It's so, it causes you to be real. It causes you to be authentic on a consistent basis. I mean, and then, like I said, it gives our kids other people to look to and allow them to kind of take ownership of their faith. And as a family, it gives us the ability to work together for something. Sims and this pastor program in the home is not a church function that we do. It's what we do as a family. And it's the one thing that we do that we pray together, we pray about together, we think through together. And so it gives us the unity to focus in as a family together as it relates to that. The other benefits of a lot of times we'll talk about kind of our home as personal, but one of the benefits that we have as a family and in our marriage is we have built-in babysitters, and that's been a tremendous blessing for us, you know. And so we're actually, you know, we get our weekly date night, but even with the weekly date night, like sometimes if we feel like we need an impromptu date, when you have people living with you, you're able to do that and find. But it's also just a tremendous sanctification of the different personalities that come into your home. Each personality brings a unique God-given gift that is built that stretches you, and that you learn more about your family and yourself. And so it is, like I said, those are just the name of a few, but the blessings are tremendous for my own personal growth. I would say doing the STEM program has helped me and our family more than it has helped anybody that has actually come through the program.
So you've been doing this for a few years now, Dahati. Have you seen, do you have specific examples of how this has led to more substantial formation than maybe other disciple-making strategies? Do you have examples of people who are now kind of moving into leadership roles, either in your church or in culture at large? Have you seen this be effective at people's lives being transformed?
Yeah, I mean, we have a guy right now we have a leadership pipeline that we have at our church that's very intentional. And so, like, even the guy we're about to test, in Decatur, which is another urban center in the city next to Atlanta. And we're about to plant a church there, and this guy, Moosey, is going to be the campus pastor there, has been through kind of our leadership pipeline. He's lived in our home. He's been through some of the other things that we've done. He's been through the STEM program. We did his premarital, and he was one of the people that actually came out here. And so he's a perfect example of someone who went through the whole process and is now planting a church there. There's all types of other people. Both Tadashi, who's a part of Reach Records, has lived in our home. Lecrae has been to the Sims program, who's also, you know, and so those are the names too. I mean, there's been some pro athletes that have lived in our home that has taken different platforms, and they're now leveraging that platform for the hope of the gospel. You know, but all of them have a community and DNA that was foundational through things like this that we have used in the STEM program and through other kind of life-on-life aspects that we do as a body.
I think that's helpful for us as we kind of listen to what you're doing, as we kind of process through this, to hear that not only has it been effective, but that you've really been able to help raise up a generation of leaders in a number of domains, not just, quote, pastors, even though you've been able to help raise those up as well, but to be able to raise up Christ-centered, gospel-advancing leaders in a number of different domains. And so I'm encouraged by that, man. I think it's challenging to us.
And, Michael, one of the things to say about that is I spend a lot of my time talking to people out of full-time vocation, you know, because things the misnomer is that if you do full-time vocational ministry, you'll get a chance to always make disciples. But the reality is that, you know, you get a chance of setting up discipleship opportunities, but you don't always just engage. And so what we try to do is unleash healthy people to do ministry where life exists and infuse them into the DNA of everyday life. And around non-believers where they can spend. You see, as a professional Christian, as I like to say it, I have to be very, very intentional about being around non-believers. You know, but people who have everyday jobs, 9-to-5 jobs, are the real heroes that they get the front line and interact with non-believers on a consistent basis and being able to do that. I feel like my job is to equip the same to do that every day.
Well, we're going to go to a commercial break now. We're going to run and just watch a couple of commercials. And then when we come back to Hadi, what I want us to do is just finish our time out together talking specifically about the Rebuild Initiative, your effort to engage urban arenas all over the country, trying to do church planting, leadership development. And so we'll talk about that here in just a second. If you're watching, remember to engage us in the chat room with questions or through social media, Twitter in particular. If you use hashtag The Exchange, we would love to hear your questions. We've already asked some on the air, and we'll do some more here in just a minute. And then don't forget that we're giving away a free copy of Dehadi's ebook entitled In Plain Sight, A Primer for Reclaiming Discipleship in the Local Church. If you'll use the link that's in the chat room, or if you'll just bit.ly/exchange giveaway. We'd love to hear from you. This is only good for those who are watching the show live. If you're watching the show on the archive version, we're sorry. Unfortunately, it's not available for you. But those who are live, make sure to take advantage of that. We'll be back in just a second after these commercials, and we'll continue our conversation with Dehadi Lewis.
Can we just get to it? I mean, is there really anything more important? I mean, of all the things we can kind of afford to fudge on or zone out in, kind of be there but not be there. Similar to security briefings on airplanes. Know it, heard it a million times, probably got it memorized, really wasn't paying attention, don't remember a thing. I mean, of all the things that are legitimately left to interpretation, like when I say something and I end it with just saying, then what I meant comes second to what you think I meant or what it means to you. Or storylines with misplaced heroes. You know, that awkward moment that you realize you've been identifying with the wrong character. You are not the hero. Me, you, us, we are not the stars of Scripture. Far from the knights in shining armor, no, we're the damsels in distress. Christ is the star. The book is about him. I mean, of all the things, of all the nuances we can miss, this, is there really anything more important? This, far more than basic instructions before leaving Earth. No, this is the one thing we know God gave directly to us. I'm pretty sure he said what he meant in it. Maybe it's time we step back, fashion a new set of glasses. Take a second look at what we might have been staring at for quite some time now and see what we ain't been seeing the whole time. I mean, of all the things we can afford to postmodernize, this, is there really anything more important? I don't know, just saying.
Let me tell you a story about a city.
A city. Both the most impressive and most depressing aspects of humanity. Fascinating diversity. A mix of color, culture, class, and tradition. Yet with a frightening reality of racism, crime, broken families, and bigotry. In the dense and diverse cities of the world, all the vices and virtues of humanity collide. But within the collision, a remnant of leaders must rise to rebuild something beautiful. Individuals who are willing to sacrifice it all to transform the areas around them. The harvest is plentiful, but the labors are few. We are to rebuild, we need leaders who are willing to dig as deep as the problem goes. The city needs the church, and the church needs leaders who will labor and leave their handprint on the city.
And welcome back to The Exchange. We're glad to have you here with us as we continue this conversation with Dahati Lewis, the pastor of Blueprint Church in Atlanta, Georgia, and the leader of the Rebuild Initiative. Don't forget, we're giving away Dahati's free ebook called In Plain Sight, A Primer for Reclaiming Discipleship in the Local Church. Check out the chat room for the link to get that. We want to make sure that you get a copy of that. Now, Dahati, let's talk about the Rebuild Initiative a little bit. The Rebuild Initiative is your effort out of Blueprint Church, right, to help multiply churches in the urban context. And tell us a little bit about how Rebuild came into being and what the purpose behind Rebuild is today.
Yeah. Ultimately, the Rebuild Network is primarily about how do we recapture discipleship and disciple-making back into the local church, specifically as we talked in the urban context. And so that's really been our heart. And it's built upon kind of burden that we see in the scripture of how we can help to accomplish the fulfill the Great Commission, the making disciples of our nation. You know, the reason why we planted Blueprint was that we wanted to be an answer to the prayer of Matthew chapter 9:38, where Jesus says, "The harvest is plentiful, but it's the laborers that are few. Pray earnestly for the Lord of the harvest to send out more laborers." We said we want to be an answer to that prayer. We want all of the churches that are part of the Rebuild family to be an answer to that prayer. We're not just having converts. We want to raise up laborers, kingdom builders, people who are willing to go about making disciples of our nation. So this is why, you know, the Rebuild Network is more of a discipleship network than it is a church network, because it's about how do we recapture discipleship and disciple making in the local church. And so that's really the heart of it, and that's why our mission statement is to multiply urban leaders with the gospel.
One of the things, Dahati, as I was looking at the Rebuild website and kind of thinking through what it is that you do, I was struck by how well you are not only making disciples, but replicating leaders. What are the things that you're using as your main avenues or your main channels through Rebuild to make disciples and replicate leaders?
Well, we built Rebuild off of four foundational principles. And one is life-on-life discipleship. The second is theological training. Third is leadership development, and then fourth is church mobilization. And so this kind of control panel is the same control panel that we use at Blueprint Church as we think through how we are to raise up for leaders. You know, the reality is that everyone has great church strategy. Everyone talks about planting churches, but the question becomes, where are these leaders coming from? And I think a lot of times what we end up doing when we say we want to plant more churches, well, we go and we try to get the one with the highest platform, and who has to have the highest platform, they say, "Hey, we're about to plant churches." And then what ends up happening is that I'll spend like a couple of weeks or a couple of months if you will slap our tag on you and say, "Hey, look what we're doing for church planting." But no one really talks about how do you take a person from a non-believer to becoming an elder and then sending them out, and what is your strategy to do that? And so everything we do is around helping churches to develop a strategy going from taking a person off the street to sending them to say, go and make disciples. You know, because that's really what we see in the New Testament. We see Paul first making disciples, and then after he makes disciples, and as people are coming to the Lord, he goes like, "Man, we need to appoint elders and deacons." And so church planting is a byproduct of disciple making, not vice versa.
I heard someone say the other day, Dahati, that you can plant a church without necessarily making disciples, but you can't make disciples without a church coming into being. I thought that was a helpful explanation as well. One of the things that you seem to be doing well within the Rebuild Initiative is using the arts. You've already mentioned that guys like Tadashi and Lecrae have come through your own personal disciple-making process, but even throughout the entire network, it seems like you're using the arts as a means of conveying gospel. First of all, is that a strategic effort on your part? And second of all, why do you find that to be such a helpful means of a channel of communicating the gospel?
Yeah, well, I think both have come from a desire, really our story and how it all came about. You know, the Christian hip-hop movement basically started with a bunch of individuals that were really trying to contextualize the gospel in a clear in a relevant way, but that was both culturally relevant and biblically sound. And so with guys like McCray and Tedashi and my good friend like the Ambassador, who are some pioneers of this kind of work, it seems like what God has done is that he's used through like media and art and things like hip-hop to get the gospel into some of the nooks and crannies of the urban context. But and now what we feel like with Rebuild is our responsibility to now come and to provide healthy, solid churches for these saints to now be raised up in. And so that's really why you see a lot of kind of a blend, because a lot of the friends, a lot of the artists, a lot of the like propaganda, and, you know, we're all kind of having the same goals, the same desire to see more disciples made, but we're just being using our different giftedness and playing our role in the larger scheme of things.
So one of the things that the Rebuild initiative, the Rebuild movement has obviously done well is engaging not only in an urban context, but with a diversity of multi-ethnic leadership. And one of the things the church has not done well for a long time is to do that same thing. What is it about Rebuild that has resonated so strongly among a diversity of ethnicities that maybe the church has not done as effectively in the past?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, the world, as you were saying earlier before, the world is becoming more multi-ethnic. You know, where they, all the stats are telling us that the idea of being urban, and when we define urban, we don't talk about inner city, but when we define urban by density and diversity, and that's where the world is going into more dense and diverse kind of a setting. And so when you have to deal with the multi-ethnic, multicultural, socioeconomic, all those issues, that, you know, it's important for us to really, for the church to be framed in that way. And so when, you know, at Rebuild, we talk about this idea that we want to be a minority-led, multi-ethnic network where it's not just about, you know, we're trying to do this football ministry and kind of black people for black people and Latinos for Latinos. And I think a lot of the church has been geared around kind of that through the kind of the church growth model or the homogeneous unit principle that we've had that is popularized by it, like the Saddleback Sam deal. And I think the problem with it is that our neighborhoods no longer look like that. Our neighborhoods are now more multi-ethnic. And I think this purely as a minority, we have to think more multi-ethnic because we are multi-ethnic. And I think one of the things that the church that has perpetuated is when it's predominantly led by the majority culture who doesn't have to think multi-ethnic, they can think homogeneous. So as a minority that is thinking multi-ethnic, we automatically think about the masses or the multitude. I don't like to say automatically, but we're more readily because our worlds are multi-ethnic and we have to deal with some of those issues. So I just think it's something that naturally, for a person like me who's grown up as what I would call a hybrid or a third culture shared, that is, you know, that it has to bounce back between different cultures in order to make it.
So thinking through that a little bit more intensely, Dehadi, there are obviously barriers to this, to a multi-ethnic ministry, a diverse leadership community. You've mentioned a few of them. What do you think are the primary obstacles? What is it that keeps the church, particularly the majority culture church, folks that look like me, you know, how is it that the majority culture churches are sort of kept at bay from engaging in multicultural ministry? Is it just a lack of cultural nuance? Do we not understand multi-ethnic ministry or what it looks like to be a part of the minority culture? What are the roadblocks that keep us from being successful?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we have to identify, and I hate to be so kind of carnal, but the reality is the eye test. When you walk into a room, the first thing you look at is, and you survey the crowd and you say, can I sit here? And that's before any music, before anything comes up. You're making that test. It's a very final approach. And I think that's one of the things that we have to, first of all, embrace all together. But I think there also seems to be an intentionality. I think one of the problems that we have with the majority culture is that, you know, we hide behind kind of this idea of stewardship in terms of resources and those types of things, and which means they're not willing to give over some of the power structure in doing it. And so this is why a lot of times you hear people say, you got to diversify your leadership. But the problem with even that statement is, you can't just bring in the black person to bring in black, to bring in more black people, or the Latino person to bring in more Latin. Or, you know, I think that's a lot of times, and minorities see that from a mile away. It's kind of what we call tokenism. And I think if we're really going to be about really saying that, we have to be willing to really give up real power so that when we come, that we're coming as spirits to the table, we're not coming as kind of subordinates. So because I think we can really learn from one another and do that. And this is one of the things that, you know, it's been really a blessing with working with people, you know, like, for instance, like with the Fans of America and with Kevin Adele and what they're doing. It's been, you know, by me being a part and coming on with them, it has, they're really given the freedom to really do this in the way that they feel that is going to be empowering and not trying to hold back.
So, Dahati, let's just have you sit for a second in the role of a coach. You're coaching a church pastor who's pastoring a predominantly majority culture, a homogeneous church. And yet he recognizes that the culture around him is changing. His own neighborhood has changed. How would you coach this pastor to begin to move their church towards connecting, understanding, connecting, and reaching a multi-ethnic, diverse culture that sort of surrounds the church?
Yeah. I think the first thing that I would say, I mean, there's a plethora of answers, but I think we have to recognize the diversity within the multi and within the minority culture. There's no one way to do it all. But the first thing that I would say to any majority leader that's championing a majority culture, I would say go on a mission trip or go and put yourself in the position where you're the minority. And I would say that's what you have to do. Put yourself where you're the minority. And as soon as you start embracing all the insecurities, the inferiority complex, all the things that you have by being in another country or being in another place where you're the minority, begin to embrace that and then begin to ask the question, how does the gospel begin to answer those types of questions? How can the church, how does the gospel answer those questions? And then that gospel is in a position as a minority to be able to understand and think about it in a completely different standpoint. That would be the first thing that I would say that you need to do is to embrace thinking of a minority if you want to be more fair.
Yeah, I think that's helpful, Dahati. I think one of the things we struggle with is just the idea of majority culture versus minority culture. I remember hearing Lecrae actually say at a conference earlier this summer, he said, we've gotten to the place now where churches have embraced a multitude of ethnicities in their church, but there's still this need for minorities to embrace majority culture in order to be acceptable in the church. And so I think this idea of embracing a multitude, not only of ethnicities, but of cultural identifications and cultural expressions, is going to be the next wave of a challenge for many in church leadership. I'm thankful for you, man, and your efforts to lead in that area. And hopefully some of us in the majority culture are listening, and we're going to begin to see this blending that's going to really look more like the kingdom than what we currently
look like. I think one of the things about that is that the majority culture has to be unity. Unification is not assimilation. And I think that is the problem that a lot of times the majority folks are seeing. It's come and do things the way we do things.
That's right.
You know, and you change your culture and you give up, but that's not what unity.
I like that sentence, unification is not assimilation. That's helpful to us. Dahati, thanks a ton for being here with us today, man. It's been a blessing. It's been a privilege to have you on the show. We appreciate you taking your time away from your family and your church to spend a little bit of time with us this afternoon.
Yeah, well, I really appreciate it, too. I mean, I appreciate you guys, your willingness. And I would like just invite anybody to come and join the conversation and continue to do this. And, you know, rebuildnetwork.org.
Yeah, man.
Rebuildnetwork.org and then at Rebuild Network is our Twitter account. So please come join the conversation as we try to reach a very dense and diverse world. You know, and it'll take all of us to do it, you know, make it happen.
Let's make some disciples together. That's exciting. I can get behind that. If you're watching, thanks so much for joining us today for this episode of The Exchange. Again, my name is Micah Fries. Ed's not here. He's on the road traveling internationally. If you would, pray for him. He's going to be speaking often overseas the next couple of weeks. And we'll look forward to being back next week. We're going to be here with Ben and Juliana Zobrist from the Tampa Bay Rays, hearing about his faith and his engagement with the culture, playing professional baseball. And so hope you'll join us for that next Tuesday. Until then, hope the Lord blesses you. Let's advance the gospel and make disciples together. See you next week.